Dans la vieille cité française existe une race de fer dont l'âme comme une fournaise a de son feu bronzé la chair. Tous ses fils naissent sur la paille, pour palais ils n'ont qu'un taudis, c'est la canaille. Eh bien, j'en suis...
There have been very few situations in the history of the world in which, without any preparation or plan, the residents of a city awake one morning to find themselves masters, without any government above them. Well, that's what happened on the morning of March 19th, 1871, in Paris. In our last episode, The Foundations of a Revolution, we learned about the origins of the Commune. Paris overthrew its national government. Louise Michel and a band of National Guards captured the French general, Lecomte, who was trying to steal the guns of Montmartre, but forgot horses. Lecomte and another general, Clément Thomas, were killed by the mob. Basically, we reached March 18th, 1871. But what happened the next morning, when everyone woke up? Who was still in Paris? Who was fighting for power? And how did it all end up with France going to war with its crown jewel, Paris? You're listening to Unraveled. The song in the background is called La Canaille, or The Mob. The song celebrates the poor working class of Paris, describing the city's citizens as belonging to a race of iron, with furnaces for souls. The hardworking mob is an immense army, and the singer wants to join. This is the second episode of the first season of Unraveled, a podcast about how movements, ideas, or events go off the rails. This episode is titled Mob Rule, and we'll dig into Paris following its surprise revolution on March 18th. Who were the powers in Paris, and what did they want? How did all the different voices in Paris end up with the Commune's election? We'll see throughout this episode, probably more than any other, the true power of a good mob. Let's start with the mayors of Paris, who sort of represented the conservative voice. Each arrondissement, or neighborhood within Paris, elected a mayor to represent it. This collection of mayors had lots of respect and power within Paris. Remember, the goal of many Parisians for more municipal power, maybe even autonomy, depending on who you asked, was not shared by everyone. There were some, particularly the wealthy, who supported the regime, respected the government, and thought the Central Committee was terrible, going to ruin the city if given a chance. They lived in the lower numbered arrondissement, like one or two. One good way to think of Paris at the time is like Panem in the Hunger Games. Panem was divided into several districts, all of which contributed to the wealth of the whole, much like the arrondissement of Paris, all contributing to the wealth of the city. There were lots of people in the lowest numbered districts or arrondissements in both Paris and Panem who weren't so fond of the revolution. When the traditional government fled Paris in the days following the 18th of March, these rich people, those who stayed a large number also fled the city, turned to the mayors to represent their interests. They generally wanted stability and a continuation of the status quo, keep everything the same. These rich people, now that the siege was over, the war with Prussia was over, were doing pretty well, and they had lots to lose from any political revolution. So who were the mayors? Well, in the first episode I mentioned Georges Clemenceau, who's a fascinating guy. Let me recap. Like everyone in France, he was furious over the Treaty of Frankfurt, which gave 5 billion francs in the territories of Alsace and Lorraine to Prussia. Clemenceau also ended up being France's prime minister during much of World War I. He was a main author of the Versailles Treaty after the First World War, which was so harsh to Germany that it has been universally cited as a main catalyst of Hitler rising to power in the 1930s. Fascinating career. But in 1871, Clemenceau was the mayor of the 18th arrondissement, which was an impoverished working-class neighborhood. He had studied as a doctor and moved to Paris to work in medicine, well, plans change, and he became a fierce political republican, He spent time in jail for writing articles that attacked then-emperor Napoleon III. The radicals who seized control of Paris after the 18th of March, and later were elected to the Paris Commune, had respect for Clemenceau, and they shared lots of values, so to speak. However, Clemenceau believed revolutions were unlikely to cause the change he wanted, and he was afraid of what might go wrong if a commune took power. He saw himself as a middleman between the radicals in the Hotel de Ville and the conservative elite at Versailles, and so he stayed in Paris, helping to guide the revolution and make it more moderate, trying to soften out the rough edges. On top of being a mayor, he also was an elected member of the National Assembly. Remember the federal government sitting in Versailles that was terrified of Paris. So due to his multiple hats, it seemed like Clemenceau was the right guy for the job of guiding the revolution. We'll see instead just how quickly Clemenceau became an afterthought. Other mayors included Pierre Terrard, a Republican like Clemenceau, who thought the revolution was too radical, and Jules Ferry, a center-left candidate who was a leading member of the National Assembly and key political ally of Adolphe Thiers. One thing that's interesting to note, in 1871 in France, most politicians held seats in local governments, in federal governments. There was certainly not any limit to the number of offices you could hold, and people for the commune were elected several different times from different arrondissements. On the other side of the political spectrum, Louis-Charles Delescluze was also a mayor, and he was a socialist Republican who became a leader of the Paris Commune. The mayors were diverse, but in the early days of the Commune, they believed that power in Paris belonged to them instead of the Central Committee. The National Guard and the Central Committee thought differently. They knew power was theirs, and they were probably right, being the people physically inside the Hotel de Ville. There's a great quote from Eugène Varlin, who was a member of the Central Committee and elected to the Commune later. He was arguing about who held power with the mayors, and all the mayors were yelling at him. Varlin was supposed to have stood his ground alone, waited for his chance to speak, and then said, quote, "You are now face to face with force," end quote. The Central Committee knew they had Paris in their hands, and the people and the guns to support them. Surprisingly, they wanted to get rid of their power and force an election in Paris for their replacements. However, their control of the city had not sprung up overnight. The Central Committee had been an important player in Paris for months, existing as a local counterweight to federal control over the National Guard. The National Guard had officially appointed commanders, of course, but the French government refused to use the National Guard in the war against Prussia. As a result of this inaction, and I guess to prove true the expression, use it or lose it, the National Guard elected its own leaders, who formed the Central Committee. While committee members were powerful amongst their constituents, outside of those small groups, these men were almost completely unknown. Their names meant nothing to most French or even Parisians outside of their own arrondissement. However, there were new elections, held by the National Guard on March 3rd, just a few weeks before the fateful March 18th. 12 new members were elected to the committee. 11 were hardcore radical socialists belonging to the International Workmen's Association. These names of the newly elected members of the committee were famous in France and beyond, and the French elite believed after March 3rd that the Central Committee took its orders directly from the dreaded Karl Marx. However, in reality, the radicals on the Central Committee were Blanquists, meaning they were followers of the French socialist theorist and activist Louis-Auguste Blanqui. Blanqui was born in the early 1800s, and he studied both law and medicine. Turning away from a bright professional career, however, he became a political activist at a young age. He was a leader of the 1848 revolutions, remember, the revolutions in Paris for the right to work, and he spent much of his life in prison after the establishment of the Second French Empire. In fact, he was in prison throughout the entire Paris Commune. Though he didn't physically set foot in Paris during the revolution, everyone considered him the leader of the Commune. He even was elected in absentia to the Commune in multiple arrondissements. He probably was a leader of the revolution, as several members of the Communard government were devotees to Blanqui's political ideology called Blanquism. Blanquism was more radical than Marxism, and while Blanqui believed in a redistribution of wealth, he considered it possible only through force. Blanqui thought socialism could only be accomplished through the dictatorship of a small, dedicated group of revolutionaries. One man who took his ideas very seriously was a Russian by the name of Vladimir Lenin. He adopted Blanqui's ideas in 1917 in Russia, remaking it as the Soviet Union to disastrous effect. In March 1871 in Paris, several Blanquists were important figures in the Central Committee and the Commune as well, once it was elected. So, we've covered the mayors, the Central Committee, and the Blanquists as really the three powers in Paris at the top. The mayors were generally conservative, representing the National Assembly. The Central Committee was more left, it was an elected body by the National Guards. And the Blanquists were far left, positioning themselves as shock troops of a revolution. And keep in mind, there was lots of crossover and mixing between the three, people belonging to more than one group. But there was also a very powerful force in Paris coming from below, called the clubs. Clubs in Paris at the time weren't just social groups, but they were much closer to political lobbies of today. There were clubs representing all kinds of ideologies, such as populism, republicanism, Blanquism, and even feminism. Most importantly, the clubs were frequented by every type of person. A journalist at the time wrote, quote, "A whole population is discussing serious matters, and for the first time, workers can be heard exchanging their views on problems which until now have been broached only by philosophers." End quote. One count offered the names of 36 different clubs in Paris at the time of the Commune, each trying to have their voices, views, and proposals heard by the government. With all of these disparate voices in Paris, it's almost surprising that any unified government was elected. The mayors tried to stop any election for the Commune, but all they could do was delay it until the 26th of March. When the Central Committee and the clubs insisted on the election taking place, many mayors actually nominated themselves. If you can't beat 'em, join 'em. Clemenceau's bid for the Commune was revealing. Despite his fame, he received fewer than 1,000 votes, losing in a landslide to his competitor. Clemenceau ran in the 18th arrondissement, which contained Montmartre, and was heavily working class. He was already seen as a political relic. The overwhelming number of men elected to the Commune were radicals. There were a few reasons for this. On one hand, many thousands, estimated by historian Robert Toombs to be 50,000, who would have voted for the conservative candidates, had already fled Paris. Many other conservatives refused to legitimate the Commune by voting. But almost 230,000 voted in the elections for members of the Commune, which was about half of the possible electorate, including those who fled. Why did the Commune receive such broad support, even from segments of the population that were middle class or higher? One reason. One of the National Assembly's first orders was to confirm rent payments during the siege would have to be paid immediately, despite the abject poverty in the city. Parisians were horrified, and many supported the Commune based on its proposal to delay or abolish those payments. Citizens felt that the Commune style of government would understand the suffering that had gone on in Paris during the Prussian siege. The Commune knew why it had support, and its very first debate was over how to get rid of rent payments while keeping the economy intact. So, who was elected to the Commune? 92 men were chosen to be members of government. Blanqui won in several arrondissements, or neighborhoods, but couldn't take his seat because he was in prison. Just over 20 elected members were moderates or conservatives who refused to take their seats due to philosophical differences with the Commune. 9 winners were Blanquists, 15 belonged to the International Workmen's Association, socialists, and yes, there was crossover between the Blanquists and the International, and then a few other independents. In the end, around 60 of the 92 elected became sitting members of the commune and actually contributed to policy. The commune was also divided into different committees, and you saw members of the commune flocking to the committees they thought matched their ideologies. Historian Robert Toombs says, quote, "Blanquists, fascinated by the seizure and use of power, dominated security and justice. Socialists moved towards finance and labor. Nearly all of the latter's members were affiliated to the International. Most of the education committee were teachers," end quote. However, even before these members were taking their seats, violence in Paris had already begun. Near the end of February, about a month before the election of the Paris Commune, a plainclothes policeman named Vincenzini was accused by a crowd of spying for Prussia. He apparently had opened a map of the city. The crowd grabbed him, beat him, tied his arms, and threw him into the Seine, pushing him under the water with boat hooks until he drowned. Afraid of violence, police officers and regular soldiers couldn't travel through working-class districts such as Montmartre or Belleville even before the revolution began. It was no surprise that Lecomte ordered his men to fire on the potentially hostile crowd on the 18th. The surprise was that the men refused Lecomte's order. In fact, Lecomte and the other general captured on the day of the revolution were executed, neither with official trial, and both were dead before the 18th had even ended. Clément Thomas was said to have been shot more than 20 times by his makeshift firing squad. On the 21st or 22nd of March, just a few days before the election of the Commune, a group of National Guardsmen fired on a demonstration of about 100 people who wanted the mayors to take control and were protesting the Central Committee. About a dozen were killed. Events like the deaths of generals and peaceful protesters gave Thiers and the National Assembly a rallying cry, around which they could gather the rest of France to their cause. The mob undoubtedly played a key role in establishing the Paris Commune, and you can see the power of the mob in just how quickly the Commune took control of Paris. When governments are put in place by mobs, this can make for an unstable situation. While domestic violence may have marred the beginning of the Commune, it was violence from outside of Paris that would come to dominate the story. The next episode, we'll dig into the beginning of the Civil War in France. You're listening to Unraveled. Eh bien, j'en suis. C'est l'homme à la face terreuse, au corps maigre, à l'œil de hibou, au bras de fer, à main nerveuse, qui sortant d'on ne sait pas où, toujours avec esprit vous raille, se riant de votre mépris, c'est la canaille. Eh bien, j'en suis.